The following Bible study is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
Greetings, everyone. Thanks for coming. And last time we went through Revelation 16, there we witnessed the final vile plagues. Chapter 17 describes the beast and the great false church, and we're going to go through that this evening. The angels that had given out the seven vials came to the Apostle John, and that's spoken of as we begin in Revelation 17 and verse 1. And there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come here, and I'll show you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. And so the angel says he'll show John the judgment of this great whore, and it's a woman who is a part of church history and prophecy. And it's said that this whore sits on many waters. And if you'll go over to Revelation 17, and verse 15, and he said unto me, These waters which you saw where the whore sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And so the scripture says that the kings have committed fornication with her, and this means that they've had intimate relationships with the church, back and forth with kings over the course of history. Today we'd say probably something like they're in bed together. Only one church has ever had that kind of power, and it is the Roman Catholic Church. Okay, next, in verse 3, so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of the names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And so now he's taken and shown the woman sitting on a beast, and the beast, of course, is symbolic of an empire, as we see through the book of Daniel. And this beast is full of the names of blasphemy, calling itself the Holy Roman Empire, and it had seven heads, and so there were seven resurrections of this beast after its wound was healed, and then ten horns, and those ten horns are the representing the same ten toes that Daniel 2 speaks of, that is, ten nations that will give their power to the beast for 1 hour. Then it continues on, describing the church. In verse 4, the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And so this again just openly and plainly shows the colors of the church. In other words, the cardinals within the church wear red. The upper level priests wear purple. Wealth and power is a part of this church. And so it is that the Vatican is arrayed in gold, and the Pope wears a gold headpiece and a bejeweled scepter to show his authority and influence. And this church has a golden cup that she holds. And these are the abominations and the filthiness. And these are the practices and the doctrines of this church. And it is filled with the ancient holidays of sex worship and the various holidays that worship the seasons like Christmas and Easter and so on. And there are also the abomination that is they through the years have tortured and brought to death the innocent. And there's foul sexual practices and relations that go on behind the scenes that the news are aware of. She has relations with the kings of the earth. Her relationship has always been a union of church and state, and she's worked closely with the kings that she allies with. And the church will tell you that they never killed anyone, even though they were responsible for the Spanish Inquisition and the Crusades. They'll tell you they never killed anyone because they had the state do it, and that was a result of their relationship with the kings that she allies herself with. In the end, the end time, the beast will be comprised of 10 allied nations. They'll be held together by the glue of that same identical religion. And God reveals the identity of that religion in Revelation 17:5. And there he says this, "And upon her head was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth." And so this church is the modern adaptation, you might say, of the ancient Babylonian mysteries, because the doctrines still come from what was Babylon so many thousands of years ago. The evergreen tree, the Madonna and child, the sex and season worship, all of that comes from this church. And, you know, as time progressed, her vileness and perversion was even recognized by those within her own ranks. And I'm speaking specifically of Martin Luther. Now, Luther was a very, very religious person. He used to flagellate himself, strike himself, and he used to crawl on his knees. He used to fast all the time. He just never could seem to do anything about his human nature, and he couldn't control it. And so he wanted to go to Rome to talk to the Pope to see if he could get some help. You know, help me with this. So he goes to Rome, and he sees that the Pope has more than one girlfriend. He sees that the bishops are having mass like every half hour on the half hour, so that they're drinking wine. They're literally, by the end of the day, they're drunk. And he sees this, and then he realizes what was probably the greatest scheme ever dreamed up in the economic community. And that is that the Catholic Church taught that God was a just God, and that his divine justice was perfect and pure, and that we were sinners, and that we deserved terrible punishment, although Christ died for us and saved us so we could have eternal life. But still, God's justice had to be served. And so as a result, they designed purgatory. And in purgatory, you would burn for a certain amount of time, depending on how many sins you had. Now they added the icing on the cake. You could do good works to get yourself out of purgatory. And so the more good works you did, like helping the poor, or going on a crusade, or dying in one of the crusades, or giving money to the church was a good work. And so this was a beautiful system, because if you gave enough money, you could get yourself out of purgatory. And if you gave more money, you could get your best friends or your wife or your daughters and sons out. And so the more money you gave the church, the more points you got, and the less time you had to spend in purgatory. I mean, it was a beautiful system when you think about it, if you were trying to scam people, that is. And so anyway, this is what Luther sees, all this. They're selling indulgences. For this much money, you get a piece of paper saying that you, these many years are removed, or, you know, your sins are wiped away for giving the church money, you know. And he was just furious. And so he wrote his thesis on the church door of Wittenberg. But what he was protesting primarily was the Pope being in charge. He didn't believe that the Pope had divine authority anymore when he saw all this. And so it's interesting that being in Germany, there had a lord and serf system there. And the serfs kind of were inspired by his rebellion against the Pope. And they said, well, we're going to rebel against our unfair lords. And what Luther said was, no, whatever lord kills a serf, in this, you can rebel against the religious authority, but you can't rebel against this, the physical material authority of this earth. And so he told them, whatever lord kills a serf will go immediately to heaven. And it really amazes me, you know, the kinds of ideas that they had back then. But anyway, the fight has been going on for a long time. So anyway, after Luther broke away from the church, numerous other groups broke off. And now, at this point, you know how it says that she had many daughters? Anybody have a guess how many Protestant churches exist today? 30,000 Protestant churches exist today. All the daughters that are broken off from the mother and then broken off from one another. And yet, what's really ironic is that they have this same theme running through them that ties them to the mother, and that is that they keep Christmas and Easter and Halloween and half of the other dozen sort of holidays that fall in between that in their own way. They're all still tied back to the mother, still tied back to ancient Babylon, and yet so many have broken off for one reason or another. So in verse 6 here, we continue on, and I saw the woman drunken, not with alcohol, but with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. Now, can you understand what it's saying when it said that she's drunken with the blood of the saints? Do you understand when you start having the authority of God, the authority of God to kill people, do you understand what that does to a person's ego? Can you see that they become arrogantly like a drunken person? You know, they're loud, they're boisterous. And can you see this group, this church, and its armies of the empire becoming loud and boisterous and braggadocio over the fact that they've killed so many people, taken over their lands, converted them to Christianity, if you will? You know, if you talk to the church, they will tell you, we never killed anyone. And they're right. They're actually right. Because the woman rode the beast. She had the controls. And she told the beast to kill them. And so it was the military part of this unification of church and state. It was the state that killed the people, not the Catholic Church per se. And so there they absolved themselves of any. It wasn't us, it was the state that did it. The military did it. And in the book, History of Romanism, on page 541, it states this: from the birth of popery in 606 to the present time, it is estimated by careful and credible historians that more than 50 million of the human family have been slaughtered for the crime of heresy by popish persecutors, and an average of more than 40,000 religion murders for every year of the existence of the Catholic Church. Can you imagine that? That many people killed because they didn't believe the same as you? Amazing what an ego can do in a human being. So this whole church is blunt, is drunken, heady, because of their saint's blood and what they've done. And further in this article, they don't really know how many were tortured, but as many as were killed were tortured for certain, and many so that they would recant. And their tortures, I did a study on this at one time, and it was just absolutely horrible. They put you on the rack, and the rack would pull you apart slowly but surely as they turned the handle. Then they made it worse. They put spikes where your back was, and the spikes would go right through you. You can't even believe some of the things they did. They would tie each one of your limbs to a horse, and then they beat the horses so they'd run, and it would literally pull your limbs off, and you'd be torn apart. So anyway, they often skinned people. I read examples where they would skin people alive. And in particular, what really amazed me was, is there was such a prejudice against women during that time that they were like viciously mean. You remember that even in the Salem in America, the witch trials they had, it was really against women. They would half drown them. They would burn their hair off. They made masks so they couldn't talk, and made them wear them in public, and they did the most weird, horrible things to women. And it just kind of incensed me when I read about that. So anyway, I remember reading a book once, and they were showing how one individual was pouring melted lead down somebody's throat, and they were telling them in the picture, you know, you will never teach that stuff again, you know, or some equivalent to that. I read it some time ago. But anyway, what also would happen is the church had this tendency of torturing people to get them to recant. And of course, a lot of people would recant their religion being tortured so severely. But then what they do is the Catholic Church would just then kill them mercifully so that they wouldn't ever recant, change their mind. So you had to believe, sign the dotted line kind of mentality. Just say those words and you're going to be okay. So next the angel reveals the identity of the beast that the woman rode. And the angel in verse 7 said unto me, wherefore did you marvel? I'll tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, go to Revelation 13 for a minute, because it says something similar, but there's a couple words I want to pick up. Revelation 13 and verse 1, where it says, and I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horn 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And in this case, back here in verse 17, chapter 17, it also says this, going to tell the mystery of the woman and the beast that carries her, which has 7 heads and 10 horns. When I looked up the words here, the fact that the woman rides on top of the beast, it's kind of interesting that the Greek is kathame, and it means to sit down, to remain or reside or dwell by. In other words, it's not just like somebody riding a horse. This is someone that is in cahoots together. This is someone that's sitting side by side. This is somebody that is, a very intimate part of the other being. And so the beast and the woman are intimately matched, intimately related together. And the other word that's used is a preposition meaning superimposition in time or place and or order. In other words, it's like one is just superimposed on the other. Do you understand how close this relationship has been down through the ages is what I'm trying to get at. That the church is an integral part of the beast. She does not have some kind of written agreement or a contract with the beast. She and the beast are in bed together. They are like married. They're so close together. So the beast is the military side of the church-state relationship. And of course there was first four, starting with Babylon and Persia and Greece and Rome. And then that empire, the fourth empire of Rome, was destroyed by the Vandals, the Heruli and Ostrogoths, a tribe, people not much unlike the Islamic radicals today. These people could not read. They were just nomadic barbarians. And Rome had so decayed that they were an easy mark for these men on horseback to ride in and conquer what was the greatest nation in the world, or empire the world had ever seen. But after that, it says that the deadly wound that she received was healed. And that took place by Justinian, and he was in the East and probably the author of the Eastern Orthodox Church. But he saw himself as a king priest, And so it began to make this turn where Christianity was starting to buddy up to the Roman Empire at this point. And finally, the seven heads started with Constantine that legalized Christianity, then made it the state religion. And so now we have the first unification, full unification of the beast and the whore together. Then came Charlemagne, who furthered the empire. Otto the Great. The fourth was Napoleon and his empire. The fifth was the Habsburg Empire. And the sixth was the Axis power. And the seventh, it says, is yet to come. And so it's not here yet, but we've gone through these six already. So the angel explains this end time history of the beast in verse 8. The beast that you saw, he says, the beast that you saw was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. And so for now, the beast is, and the church too, is in a kind of a lockup. That it existed for a certain time and then it's locked up. So it was, and then it was not, but now it's going to come again. So it's locked up until the timing is right. And for now, the power of the church is limited. And her religion is debated among many, and it's repudiated by some, and there's no harm done to them. As a result, a lot of people think that when it talks about the whore, for example, or even the beast, they think that it's not the Holy Roman Empire anymore because it's been so inactive for so long and has so had so little power. Some say it's actually radical Islam. There's numerous people that believe that the beast is radical Islam. Others say that Babylon is America. You know, and many people claim that it's the UN because there's a combination of nations. Of course, there's way more than 10 in the United Nations. But the point is, the world is going to be absolutely dumbfounded. They know the history of this great empire that continued on and on and on for centuries, and now it's nothing. The Vatican is a small little area with 800 people in it and I think 400 square miles, and that's all it is. But eventually it's going to grow large, huge, take over the world pretty much, and people are going to be dumbfounded because they're going to go, wow, what happened to the United Nations? What happened to America? What happened? All of a sudden, things are going to move so fast, they're just going to be shocked because of it. And you can see why, I think, pretty easily. The world will be dumbfounded because this power is again going to emerge, but it's going to have more strength, more power than it ever had in the past. And it's going to ally with a false church and a false prophet who is going to be able to work miracles. And that's just going to increase people's belief in it and the power that it's able to wield. But eventually it says it's going to go into perdition, and perdition, I looked up, is a state of abomination after your death. And so my point is that after this church and after this Satan's influence is done, when it's all said and done, if it's ever referred to in the future, in the kingdom or later on, is going to be referred to as an abomination. It's going to be absolutely... Right now, nobody thinks of the church as an abomination unless you're a child and had some pedophile priest. Nobody thinks of it as an abomination in that sense. It's just the church that even has, you know, a place in the UN because it's a city-state. And so it has a position there. It still has high credibility. So anyway, the next, the beast, is identified to us in verse 9. And here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And there are seven kings, five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. And so remember, the seven heads are mountains, and that mountains are always a symbol, biblically, of a government. Even God's government is symbolized by a mountain. And the church is so the church sits on or rules over seven different governments, and those are the ones that we read about, of course. So anyway, don't forget that it says this, that the this individual in verse 9 is going to ascend out of the bottomless pit. It's going to exist for a while, then it's going to go into perdition, and they that dwell on the earth are going to wonder when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. And so we see it's buried now, but it's going to come back, and the world's going to be shocked. Eventually it's going to go into perdition, it's going to be put to death, and it's going to have a reputation that is an abomination. So let's go to 9 and 10 here. And here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And there are seven kings, five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. And so my point is that these seven heads are seven mountains or seven governments, and that, you know, five have come, you know, and are past, one is, and one is yet to come. Now, why I say this is because, you know, the scriptures say in Daniel, seal up this vision, because Daniel talks about these empires, and he talks about the one that's going to be at the end in in Daniel 12. But the point I make is that God tells him, seal up the words. They're not for now. They'll only be understood at the end. One, okay? Then two, Christ said, Matthew 24 and verse 21, he said that the tribulation was going to come, and it was going to be so severe that if he didn't return, that there would be no flesh left alive. Well, that could only happen when? You know, down to the people say, well, people have always said the end is near. They've said that for centuries. Yeah, but we never had the power to erase all life off the planet. We have that now. The world has 30,000, interesting number, 30,000 nuclear warheads. That's how many we have. And we saw what one did to Nagasaki, Hiroshima. Imagine it. We have the power to wipe human life off the face of the planet more than once. We have that power. So this is the time that it's talking about. So it's talking about around World War II, and the Axis powers were, and yet there's one yet to come. And we're in that position now where we're waiting for one to come. And we see America's decline preparing. We see Europe suddenly having to do something because Russia is creeping around into Ukraine, adding more weaponry recently. We see the Middle East acting crazy. ISIS is becoming a massive power that is very threatening, and so something has to happen. You know, before World War I, before World War II, the world realigned itself. People made alliances with other people, and everything was in a state of flux and change, and then bang, suddenly a trigger, something goes off. That's the same thing we're going to see. And we're in that period now, the lull before the storm, except the lull, the breeze is starting to blow and the water is getting choppy. You know, we're starting to really see things happen that we've always known were going to happen. So anyway, one of the things that I want to bring out is about a book, because we're talking about the Nazis or the Axis powers as being a, as Mussolini said, a resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. A book was published in 1999 by the British journalist John Cornwell, and it detailed the actions of Eugenio Pacchielli, and who was Pope Pius XII during the Nazi era. Cornwell showed that the Pope assisted Adolf Hitler. In fact, the book is called the Pope, Hitler's Pope. But he assisted the Nazi regime, and he pushed through the Reichs Concordat. This was an agreement between the Church and Hitler's Nazis, and he showed how the Church did little to help do anything to save any of the Jews during the Holocaust. And this Pope Pius, his entire career was to be the diplomat from the Vatican to Nazi Germany. So Pius' desire was to increase and centralize the power of the papacy, and it's said that he was visibly anti-Semitic. So he was glad they were killing Jews, you know. And that was, again, this alliance of church and state, that people don't realize how much of a role the Catholic Church played during that time. So anyway, he subordinated any opposition to the Nazis and their goal. And so back to Revelation 17 and verse 11. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven, and he goes into perdition. And so the beast, of course, that is talking about adds in the fourth beast, the Roman Empire, before it became the Holy Roman Empire. And that beast was destroyed, but it's still counted in this particular count. So that fourth beast died and was revived again. And again, the one who revived it saw himself as a priest king. So he was a professing Christian, the leader of what is now the Eastern Orthodox Church. And verse 12, and the ten horns which you saw are ten kings which have not received a kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. And so these powers are, these ten do not exist today. They do exist, but they don't exist in this form that they're going to finally take. Somehow Europe will probably be either redivided, or God is counting from the standpoint of the nations as he sees them, not as we draw the lines. So it's either way. The ten nations are going to exist as powers that give their power to him for a while, and 1 hour with the beast. And some have played some number games with that, and it comes out to be a few years. So how long was that, a week, Terry, that it came out to be? Do you remember that discussion? Didn't come from us. Somebody else. Okay, so anyway, what's going to happen is these 10 nations are going to be led by the beast power, and the beast power is going to eventually, as America wanes and declines and is no longer a major peacekeeping force in the world and cannot be depended upon, he takes it upon himself to go solve the Islamic problem, and he goes down to the Middle East and he takes over those nations and he sets his tabernacle or his palace, as it were, in the Holy Land, and he sits in the temple and calls himself God. And in the meantime, the false prophet is working miracles, and he's like a John the Baptist figure, pointing to the beast and saying, follow him. In all likelihood, he's saying he is the Messiah, and that's why he would sit in that temple and call himself God. And that's why you would think that he even had the power or the authority to do that. And he's going to bring then, God will bring all of the military from all of these nations around the world, he's going to bring them down to Megiddo. And there he personally makes war with them. And I remember in Zechariah where it talks about the flesh melting out of their eyes melting and their tongue melting out of their mouth. And I think that's when that takes place. When he comes back and he faces the army and they're about to fire on him, I think he just reveals, this is just my opinion, but I think he reveals himself the way he is. Look who you're fighting. And he just lets them see the glory that radiates from him, enough to light up with the Father the entire New Jerusalem. When he shows himself as he is, when he was on Mount Sinai and he gave the Ten Commandments, what happened to Sinai? Burned up. So what would happen to anybody that was facing him? Burned up. And that's what I think happens here. So they're going to come to their end that way and be completely destroyed. Verse 14, these shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. That's who we want to be. So he's going to fight these, going to bring the military might of the world down to one central location, and he's going to destroy him in one fell swoop. And in that way, he has time to rebuild Jerusalem and start telling the nations, you come up, and sending representatives down. But he's first going to rebuild Jerusalem, and he's going to bring back the Israelites in that second Exodus that we're aware of. He's going to bring them back. He's going to establish them, rebuild that. And by destroying all the armaments of the world in one fell swoop, he's going to give himself time to do that. And then he said unto me, the waters which you saw, which we read earlier, where the horse sits, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And what I didn't say last time, we understand as people and nations and tongues, but look at the implication of this word, of this verse. This is looking like a lot of people, doesn't it? This is like a whole bunch, nations of people, and like a sea of them. And so he's talking about a lot of them. And then he says in verse 16, the 10 horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. So the 10 kings eventually turn on the whore. And most people don't realize that aspect. But there's always been a power struggle between the church and the state. And always there's a power struggle in marriage. There's a power struggle in corporate America. There's a power struggle wherever you go when you have human nature. And so these two have a power struggle that has always gone on. Well, here's how they played it. In the early development of the church and the state and their arrangement, the state said, or the church said to the state, you have power over the physical worlds and countries and peoples. We have power in heaven. And so our power is greater than your power. And for that reason, the popes always were the ones who would crown the emperors. And it wasn't until, and this went on over and over and over until finally Napoleon Napoleon, the Pope comes up to crown him. Napoleon grabs the crown, puts it on his own head. And because of this power struggle, who's got more power, me or you? And he's saying, I got my own power. I don't need you. And so that has changed the complexion of the relationship between these two for a long time. So what happens at the end then, think of it for a minute. If you have been convinced, or you have convinced the world that you are the Messiah, that you are God, that you're in the temple, and you now have made the sacrifice to stop, okay? You've got that kind of power. And now, what's the threat? Power number two, the church. And so you can see where he could say the church is corrupt, and he could order the those 10 nations under him, take her out, you know, because she is a corrupt church, because I'm God and I know and I say so. And so he turns on the church that has actually helped get him in power. And it's not like we haven't seen this in governments and seen this in marriages and seen this in corporations in America. So in verse 17, God has put it in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And so God put it in their hearts to follow what this beast says. So they're believing he's God. They're believing it. And the woman which you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Now that city is very small right now. And it's going to become a great city. People probably don't realize the wealth of the Catholic Church right now, but the Catholic Church owns cleaners, they own movie houses, they own stores, property, all through America, all over the place. And they have only 110 acres with over 800 people in it. It seems small in comparisons, but bankers' best guesses about the Vatican's wealth put it at 10 to 15 billion. The Vatican has big investments in banking, insurance, chemicals, steel, construction, real estate. Unlike ordinary stockholders, the Vatican pays no taxes on their income. And so they're pretty wealthy, and they're going to become even more wealthy as they grow in the future in influence and in power. So still today, they own many, many businesses in our country and in other countries around the world. So soon they are, while a small city state right now, they're going to grow and their influence is going to grow. And as the Pope before, our present Pope, as he said when he would go on tour, Europe, your only solution to your problems is to go back to your roots. You have to go back to your roots. In other words, the glue that held these disparate nations together is their ancient ties to the Catholic Church. That's their roots, and that's the glue that will hold them together. And so while he preached that and was very political, now we have a lamb. You know, we have the Mr. Nice Guy Pope, who everybody seems to really love because he just, you know, is changing things, and he's the one that washes other people's feet. He's the one that is serving and giving and nice and peaceful appearing. So I think a lot of people are going to build trust in him, and it may be, I'm not saying it is, but it may be that he will play an essential role in the end time, because I believe we're closer than we think. Because of the way things are happening and how soon they're happening. Soon, they're going to be able to control nations, the power that she has. But her glory is going to be for only a very short time. Christ is going to come, he's going to destroy her, and she will forever be thought of as an abomination. And he will bring, for the first time, real peace and real harmony between the church and the king that he sets up to rule the nations, and those that of us who, if God is willing, will work in cities and will have mayors and so on that work under us as we administer God's government. And finally, the world will come to a point of peace and harmony when this finally concludes. So, keep watching world news and keep watching our character, our personal character. And let's strive to stay close to God and make our relationship with Him more meaningful and have more effect on our behavior and our thoughts.